Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. .podbean.com.
One by one we lost the roses of days of yore. Where is the solid ground? We didn't care. We made a pretty prayer. We scattered roses everywhere. One by one we've lost the roses. Who counts the cost? Throw out that one last rose. Another one. We'd laugh and have our fun. We didn't know our race was run. We didn't know our time was done. One by one we lost the roses.
That was pretty awesome in all sorts of marvelous ways. It was almost like stepping back into the 20th century. And I know we were talking about the Alamo recently, but maybe we don't remember the Alamo, but we do remember the last rose that we've just actually heard, the awesome connection there by Ted Sylar. And that one last rose featuring, of course, Byron Berlin and Dan Dugmore. And guess what? We have got Ted Seiler with us right now. Ted, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Alex?
That's great. We had a slight freeze there when we thought we connected. You're in Pennsylvania, so you're coal miners' country. So we can appreciate that. Who knows what could happen there?
Technically, it's Pennsylvania Dutch country, but let's not get technical there.
Listen, you know, you're perfectly entitled. You live there. You need to obviously express what it is that and where you're based. Now, this album, of course, we just heard the track from that. That was, of course, that one Last Rose. It's defined as a honky-tonk country music album. I said in the intro, it's a bit like going back in time. You've had pretty much six decades of music writing experience. So you go back to the 20th century, etc. Was this something you always had in mind to actually, in a sense, enough of the synthesizers, enough of all of this disco material, enough of all this artificial intelligence, etc. Let's just have good musicians on a good album with good music.
Well, yeah, sure. I've been pretty much a traditionalist since, I'll date myself here. Back in the 60s, me and my friends, when we were kids, we liked the top 40 like everybody else. But we quickly learned who their influences are, who the Beatles listens to, who the Rolling Stones listen to, and we started listening to them. Chuck Berry, Little Richard, and then back further to the blues guys, Robert Johnson, Jimmy Reed, always loved Jimmy Reed, and the country guys too that they look back to, especially Hank Williams. It's funny, I was influenced by that not very great Hank Williams movie they made with George Hamilton. But they played all Hank Williams songs when I was a kid. And I watched it on vacation one time. I went, wow, that's great music. I wish I could write a Hank Williams song. And so I've been interested in traditional style American music since that time. It's not the only thing I play. I've played a lot of different things, but yeah, I have. And then I realized only recently, around 2017 or so, that I could make an album myself. Because before that, you had to go into a studio. You had to pay for a studio. And even then, it was once and done. You do one take and you're out of there. And take far enough that I could do this myself. I had to teach myself. It was a long learning curve. But, I downloaded a digital audio workstation and got a nice mic and a computer interface, and it was off to the races. And
the result was pretty outstanding.
Yeah, I always wanted to do it. In other words, what? Excuse me?
The result was pretty outstanding, as we've just heard. Now, obviously...
I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, you cover vocals, your guitars, your rhythm section as well. But as mentioned, you've got Byron Berlin and Jason Carter on fiddles. You've got Dan Dugmore on pedal steel and a certain Kristen Scott Benson on banjo. Now, they're all pretty seasoned pros as well, I gather.
Yeah, they're the greatest. I mean, they really make it outstanding. If I do say so myself, they really kick out the jams on these songs. Byron Berline, especially, I'd like to mention, since we got three songs done, and then sadly he died. Well, we were going to do one more song, and that's how I ended up getting Jason Carter to finish it out. Byron, he was legendary. He played with everybody. The thing that first put him on the map was playing with the Rolling Stones on a song called Country Honk, which is a country version of Honky Tonk Women. The story of it is on the internet. You can listen to it. He tells it in a great old country way, the story of how he had a call late at night from Keith Richards, who was three sheets to the wind, and he thought it was a joke, Who's this? What are you talking about? No, we're going to fly you out to L.A. from Oklahoma and make a record tomorrow. it was an amazing story. But anyway, when I got Byron Berline to play on my record, I was amazed. I emailed him, and he emailed me back and said, "Sorry, it took me a while. We were having tornadoes here, but I'd be glad to do it. I like your song, and thanks to technology again, I was able to send him a rough cut. He played the part. He sent me back a track with his part, and I plugged it into the song, and there you go. Neither of us had to leave Pennsylvania or Oklahoma."
Yeah. Having said that, though, Ted, it's interesting you've got a big international link here, because the mixing and mastering for the album was, I see, done in Gmünd in Germany, and your cover art was produced by Nuzza Avliani in Tbilisi, Georgia. So, you know, you've certainly gone global as far as the Northern Hemisphere is concerned.
Yeah, that's that internet thing again, you know. I just looked around for somebody who looked good, and those two people were the best I could find. If you look at my cover art, it's really great, and the engineering, it's perfect. He did it in that classic Ray Price style, which is what I wanted. And those are the perfect people for me.
Now, we've listened to that one, Last Rose. We're about to actually play She's the One. That features Jason Carter and Kristen Scott Benson. Would you like to actually just give us a little backstory in terms of what your concept was when you were producing She's the One?
Well, with that one, I'd written it a while back. I wanted a faster song. I'd done medium tempo and slower songs, and I wanted something that went a little faster. And if you look on my YouTube site, you'll see I have 100 demos of songs I've written, just playing acoustic guitar, you know, and singing. And I poked through them. I hadn't looked at them in a while. I go, "Oh, She's the One. I want to do that one." I realized it's more or less a bluegrass song, and this needs a banjo on. So I found Kristen's email. You know, I looked through Wikipedia through various banjo players, and I go, "She looks like the one for me." And I contacted her, and she said, "Yeah, sure." And she really is an impressive banjo player. She plays with a group called the Grascals, who in bluegrass circles, at least in the United States, is one of the top bands, as well as Jason Carter, who plays the fiddle on this tune. He's with the Del McCoury Band, who's one of the top names also. I just contacted both of them through email, and we did it the same way I did it with Byron Berline and Dan Doug Moore. They sent me tracks, and I put it together. But that was my up-tempo song for the record.
A crying shame. She's the one I love so. She's the one, and she doesn't even know. She's the one I adore. She's the one my heart beats for. Department store, nightgowns and lingerie.
podcast award and ask her out on a date. And when she sees me coming so self-assured that we'll seal our fate, she's the one I love so. She's the one, and she doesn't even know. She's the one I adore. She's the one my heart beats for. She's the one. 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 Yeah, she's the one.
Well, also, let's not forget Jason Carter, 3-time Grammy winner, 5-time Fiddle Player of the Year winner.
Yep.
And as you mentioned, Kristen Scott Benson, of course, 5-time Banjo Player of the Year winner. So you certainly got some good quality within that. I mean, from your own perspective, you've written country, you've written rock and roll, you've written classical, jazz, rhythm and blues, etc. Is it just a case of whatever, wherever the mood takes you, or do you have a particular fondness for something which is important? I mean, we said Last Rose album, it's honky-tonk country style. What sort of angle do you like to go for?
Well, I guess it's just as the mood takes me, or at various periods in my life. I've written those different styles of music depending on what band I'm playing in. I wrote a lot of jazz stuff. I do a lot of cocktail piano for your dining enjoyment, you know, and I have a great stand-up bass player. And then I play old jazz standards. Well, then the jazz standards get into my brain and I start writing some songs like that. For the country, I was filling in a band up in the Poconos. That's in the coal regions. And they played classic country, and they played for a really big dance. They have these country dances out there in the country, and there's like 300 people there. And I was really impressed. And I played all these classic country songs, which I knew before, but I played them a lot. And they got in my brain, and I started writing classic country songs, and I really got into that big place. Sound the leader of my band, Bill Murray, he was really into Ray Price, and Ray Price is one of the founders of the honky tonk town, and so I started writing honky tonk songs, and I realized there's an audience out there for this. There's an audience of rural people, older rural people that love the classic country sound, and also urban hipsters. You know, they like it too. You can go to hear this kind of music in New York City and certain clubs, Lower East Side or something like that.
Well, again, over your career, I see you've played rock and roll at high school hops, blues in Texas roadhouses, country in rural fire halls, jazz piano in smoky cocktail lounges. And you've even sung Johann Sebastian Bach in Saxony and 12-tone music a cappella.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a tribute basically to the notion of obviously tenacity and persistence and lines with respect to that. I mean, obviously you combine your music with a day job and other areas within that. Has the career panned out as you'd anticipated, or is it a case of, well, I never expected to be actually talking via Zoom to a British radio station in 2023 about my latest album?
Well, yeah, I definitely never expected to do that. and the reason I have all that stuff is, you know, I've been around for a long time, you know, and it piles up. It looks like it looks like I did it all at once, but no, I did it over a long period of time. Yeah, and I stuck all that stuff on the website just because I thought the variety would be interesting and entertaining. We really did it. It's all true, though. I had a great choir director back when I was in high school who got a bunch of teenage kids to sing 12-tone music a cappella, believe it or not. I can't believe it. I couldn't do it now. I don't know how he got it. I guess young, you know, fresh minds could do it. But yeah, I've done all that stuff. But right now, I'm really concentrating on the honky tonk
country
and my new album. And I have another album in the works too that has a Dan Dugmore and Jason Carter so far on it. I think I'm going to try to have another bluegrass number on it too, with and use Kristen banjo.
Fantastic. Certainly tedsiler.com is presumably the best place to actually keep abreast of the things that you're actually doing. Are you on any other social media as well, or is it a case of, no, I leave TikTok and Instagram and Facebook for the young people?
I have an Instagram site and I have a Facebook site. I admit I don't use them all that much. I've been using the Facebook site for playlists, contacting playlist curators. That's basically what I'm concentrating on right now. They tell me that's the way to go. So, I'm on 20 or 30 playlists here and there, getting some listeners that way. Got radio, of course. It's harder to track the radio. I'm glad you did this, because now I know at least you're playing my songs over there. Are you in London, by the way? Is that where you're at?
No, we're in Lincoln. That's Lincoln, England, and not Lincoln, Nebraska. An easy mistake you can make, but, you know, very important to work through that. Although, obviously, through our podcast, people listen to us all over the world, even in Australia. But there we are.
Of course.
It's been fabulous sharing some thoughts with yourself, Ted, today. We featured the original That One Last Rose to start off with. Obviously, had She's the One. We're going to wrap up with a little tribute to, obviously, the late Byron Berline with a mix of That One Last Rose. But we've got two final questions to actually ask you in any case. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer on the show today for the Midweek Drive? Has it been good for you?
Of course, it's more than reasonably. It's unreasonably interesting.
Yeah. Ted, we're British. We always underscore these things. You know, we it's a natural thing in us, basically. We sort of ease back on that. So, you know, that's good.
Everybody listen to Alex. That's what I say.
Well, then the next critical question is, will you be kind enough to join us again? Will you come back on another Midweek Drive in the near future?
You bet.
Ted Seiler, we salute you. Would you like to just introduce yourself and the band, of course, with this mix of That One Last Rose? Over to you.
All right. Well, I'm Ted Seiler, speaking from Catasauqua, Pennsylvania, which is near Allentown, Pennsylvania. I'm sure you've all heard of Allentown.
Billy Joel.
You know, it's got its little song about it. And then my band are legendary musicians. Byron Berline, who played with everybody, and Dan Dugmore, who was with Linda Ronstadt and James Taylor for 20 years, and Jason Carter, who's playing with Del McCoury, Bluegrass Band, and Kristen Scott Benson, the great banjo player from the Grascals from South Carolina.
One by one we lost the roses of days of yore. Where is the solid ground? What are you hanging round here for? One by one we've lost the roses. There ain't no more. That one last rose and gently close the door. Mm-hmm.
roses. We didn't care. We made a pretty pair. We scattered roses everywhere. One by one we've lost the roses. Who counts the cost? Throw out that one last rose. It goes with those we've lost. There goes another one. We'd laugh and have our fun. Run. We didn't know our time was done. One by one we've lost the roses. They go so fast. Throw out that one last rose, and with it goes the past.
Teenagers head back to Spiritwood on foot, but a severe thunderstorm strikes before they reach the town, forcing them to break into an abandoned country school to take shelter. It already sounds thrilling, it sounds menacing, it sounds as though it could well be a must-read. It's The Ghosts of Spiritwood, and we're delighted to welcome the author and creator of The Ghosts of Spiritwood to our Author of the Week feature, following, of course, our little bit of honky-tonk music that we heard earlier. It's Martine Noel Moore. How are you, Martine?
I am doing great, Alex.
Excellent. It's great to connect with your good self. Of course, this is not by any means your first book. I mean, since graduating back in the day, I think you've got 16 books to your credit. So I think prolific is an adjective which we could actually apply from that perspective.
I guess we can say that. And next month, number 17 is coming out.
Ah, the teens continue, basically, which is excellent. Yep. Well, let's talk The Ghosts of Spiritwood, because clearly what you've got there in that initial line is a kind of classic start to the sort of notion where the reader might be saying, don't go there at all. What was the inspiration behind producing this particular text?
This particular text was created in the context of a whole project. It was actually, so far I've written 7 books, young adult books that way, which is when I get invited into a school and I give a series of writing workshops. I get there, it's really carte blanche. I have no idea what we're going to talk about, what kind of story is going to be, who the characters are going to be. It is really like the really carte blanche, like I said. And from working, you know, doing workshop in small groups and in big class, then we come up after week after week after week mm-hmm. with the genre of story they would like to write. Obviously, this one was a scary ghost story. That's what they signed up for, and that's what they got. And then we developed the characters and the ambiance and the location. And the location in that case came up pretty quickly because we have this very small town north of Saskatchewan in the Canadian prairies, which is called Spirit Wood. So couldn't have been a better title.
Well, the more discerning listener will probably be able to detect a slight French accent there. And it's worth noting, of course, that The Ghosts of Spirit Wood is the first English edition of what, of course, was originally Les Fantômes de Spirit Wood. And apologies for the accent there. It opens from that point of view. So let's, I mean, that whole balance is clearly, it's something I think sometimes is forgotten, the kind of Anglo-French nature of Canada and so on. Is there any difference in terms of the way that young adults are relating to these kind of things? Or is it a case of no, if it works in French, it'll work in English as well?
Well, that's the what I thought with this one, because Les Fantômes de Spirit Wood was published in 2010. And I presented it in every province in Canada except for Newfoundland. Haven't been invited there yet, but sometime soon, I hope. And even like 10, 12 years after it's been published, we keep reprinting because it keeps selling. It's very popular in schools. And last year, the original publisher did a second edition, and that's when I thought, gee, why did you know? I'm a translator from English to French for other authors' books, and I thought, why wouldn't I do one of mine? You know, from French to English, and so that's what I did, and I got, thank God, a very good revisor because my English is obviously English is obviously my second language. And I submitted it to Shadowpaw Press in Regina, and they said yes right away. And so far, the reception is really overwhelming. I am floored by the reviews that this little book is getting. And yes, I think that it works with kids either in French or in English, because the group of students that I worked with, grade 7 and 8, were from an immersion school. So that means a French immersion school. So that means that all of these kids, like 32 of them, are Anglophones who are learning French at school. They live their day in a French school. And so I guess maybe there was some affinity there with their imagination that can relate to the Anglophones also.
Now, you're born and raised in Quebec, but you've been based in Saskatchewan since 1993. Curiously, the same year I actually started teaching at the University of Humberside and then the University of Lincoln. So,
Early.
interesting year back in the day. Who would have thought it? Oh, 30 years later, still battling through on that system. I'm intrigued in terms of obviously your choice of studying French literature. I mean, clearly there are huge, huge quality aspects of French literature, but I was often struck by the quote from C.S. Lewis when he was commenting on Alexandre Dumas and the Three Musketeers. He said, "The thing about the Three Musketeers, you can only read it once, and then that's it. It lacked step." I would have disagreed with that. So, you know, in terms of that, just share with us, why did you decide to actually go for French literature? Or are you more of a person who, in the classic words of Recherche à la recherche de temps perdu, in remembrance of things past,
Ah,
you'd actually say
yeah.
Marcel Proust? That's my kind of
Yeah.
writer.
Marcel Proust, À la recherche du temps perdu. I must confess that this is the only book that was on our reading list when we start the bachelor degree in French literature. The first year, we have a reading list of that comprise 100 books, poetry, drama, essays, and novels. And the only book in that very long list that I was not able to finish was À la recherche du temps perdu. So I
You
am
should have
not a
had more
big fan of
cake,
Marcel
Martine. You should
Proust.
have had more cake to dissolve the cake in the cup of
Yeah, you
tea.
need
That's what
more
you needed.
Madeleine. Yeah. More Madeleine maybe would have helped. But I was born in a very working class mining town. My parents had a grade 7 and grade 9. So going to college, university, that was like way, and I'm like, it was not even in my realm of imagination. And so I was a high school dropout, like probably half of the kids in my town. But when I turned 18, my big dream was I'm going to move to Montreal, to the big town, to become a professional model. So when I turned 18, that's what I did. Then when I started modeling, I was modeling mainly in showrooms, which is where the buyers from the stores come to see the new collections. But between shows, there was nothing to do. So we were just sitting there, and I started reading novels. And I really got into liking that. And then a few months later, I registered to a night class, a night adult class in a cégep, which is like a junior college in Quebec, and a novel class. And I just loved it so much. After a few months, I just quit modeling and I went back to college and then university for 5 years at university, 6 years. Yeah, so it was not a plan, but I guess I was destined to do it.
Well, more than that, of course, you've been longlisted for the Prix de la Nouvelle, Radio Canada. You've also been shortlisted for the Prix du Récit, Radio Canada, and you're an editor, publisher, and translator. Do you kind of juggle those tasks as a matter of course, or is it a case of no? I'm going to wear my editing hat on today, or today I'm going to wear my translating hat. And today, basically, I'll be my creative writer.
It is actually interesting to juggle because I'm not always in a creating mood. I schedule my days. I always have more than one writing project on the go. So my morning are dedicated to writing. And in the afternoon, then I would edit a more advanced project. You know, like right now I have four novels and one play on the go, like a more advanced manuscript. And if I do work as an editor for my publisher or somebody else or some authors, because I also help the authors, then that's the afternoon work. The translation, that's like anytime, often in the weekend, because there's only so many hours in a day. But yeah, I like to do that because it offers a lot of variety.
There's a wonderful French quote, and I must admit the source of it has escaped me, but it's, I think, it goes something like, les hommes heureux n'ont pas d'histoire, which I think roughly translates, yes, happy people don't make history. I'm just wondering in terms of, from your viewpoint within, obviously, Canada and so on, and indeed your writer, are your characters, do you actually like, as the creator of your characters, to give them challenges to overcome? Or do you actually see them as in a sense, ciphers that you say, you go there, and so on?
Well, this is one of the first things I tell the students when we do the workshop, when we come up with the plot lines. I tell them that les gens heureux n'ont pas d'histoire. If you stay home and watch TV, not much is going to happen to you. But if you put yourself out there, if you risk trying something new, then there will be obstacles, most likely. And the obstacles and how you overcome them is what makes life interesting. Like in the case of The Ghost of Spiritwood, Ethan, the main character, has some, how would I say, some personality issue, maybe. He's extremely self-conscious about his look. Like he's a star football player.
It's presumably Canadian football as opposed to British football or soccer.
Oh yes, American football.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, he dyes his hair. He wears like blue contact lens. He lives with his mother, who's a psychologist. She's a single mom. And at school, he's being bullied as being poor. So he carries a lot of shame also. So I like to, you know, give them some frailties, and then, but at the end, of course, he becomes the hero of the story.
Well, the classic, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, as Friedrich once said, Mr. Nietzsche. Or was it Kelly Clarkson? I get them confused these days. Everything blurs over. Let's talk a little bit about the phenomenon of young adult readers and so on, because I think it's fair to say that the 20th century brought to the world the notion of the teenager back in the 1950s. And then probably somewhere it seemed to be around about 1990s, this whole new genre, the young adult, seemed to develop. And clearly there are certain authors who've thrived and really developed with respect to that. Do you feel as though actually sometimes the book industry is too guilty of compartmentalizing. And actually, a good book is a good book is a good book. It really doesn't matter how chronologically gifted you are. You know, people can actually appreciate good writing, whether it be Daniel Defoe or indeed Martin Noel Moore, at any particular sort of time of the day, really, or their lives.
That's an interesting question, because I know when I grew up, you had either picture books or adult novels.
Yeah.
There was nothing in between. Or there was maybe in French, the La Comtesse de Ségur, with the little Sophie who was always in trouble, but not much in between. And what I find interesting working in schools, like doing workshop presentations and readings and name it, is that there are really, like, I don't write the same way when I write for teens. You won't find any long descriptions, atmosphere and all that in my young adult novel. The story moves through dialogue, because dialogue is a lot more dynamic especially for a young reader, you know, to go from one character to the next. So I like doing that, and that's also why I like writing plays.
And if we kind of if we progress that a little bit in terms of, as you said, dialogue is very important and so on. What about the role of graphic narratives and sequential storytelling, and indeed, you know, the notion of the Ghosts of Spiritwood actually having a comic book version of it and translating into another medium? Is that something which you have in mind? Do you think actually it would work on that basis as well?
Well, I started working on the play adaptation of it. I think it would make a great movie with CGI, you know, all the things that we could do with the ghost, because there's more than one ghost in that story, plus all the ghost stories that the characters tell each other at the beginning of the book. But I think it could have, you know, many déclinaisons in French, like many different versions of the story.
I'm just smiling because in an alternate reality, it would be made into a movie already, and the late François Truffaut would be writing scholarly articles on it in Cahiers du Cinéma, and we'd have a whole different conversation. But yeah, it's just a thought, really. Let's move back to our reality, at least. We often ask our authors, do you have a particular playlist or music that you like to listen to whilst you write, or do you prefer perfect silence? Do you prefer just soundtracks? Do you like lyrics? Are you somebody who will actually say, yeah, unless I actually have Edith Piaf singing La Vie en Rose, I can't write 1,000 words. That's it, basically.
Really?
Where would you actually see yourself? Do you have anything that you'd apply from your own personal writing work?
From my personal writing, I would say that, well, most of it really is done in silence. I cannot write, even if I write, like, you know, like any kind of business writing, articles, whatever, I cannot do it if I hear other people's words, like lyrics, a song. I can't. But there's a couple of my books that I wrote listening to one soundtracks, like over and over again for like 3 months or 6 months. Like my the first award I won was for Amelia et les Papillons, Amelia and the Butterflies. And I had this a CD of a sort of a whimsical music that played during the whole time. Wow. But you know, most of the time, it's total silence.
Interesting. Let's talk about the technology of writing, because one of the things I've certainly noticed over the last 30 years is the scarcity of students these days who actually use a device that yourself and myself might refer to as the classic pen, or indeed something to actually write with it with an input from that point of view, because it tends to be all very keyboard based and so on. Some authors we speak to feel it's still important to actually have that physical connection between the paper and a pen, etc., or writing implement, etc. Others say, no, it's got to go straight onto the keyboard as soon as possible, or the Padlet, or the tablet, or other sort of zones. So within that technology, where do you pitch yourself in terms of, I mean, I'm presuming you're not going to turn around and say, actually, I still use a typewriter.
The best purchase of my life, Alex, I was 13 years old. I had my first summer job. And I was earning $50 a week. So I took my salary from almost the whole, like $250, and I bought myself a typewriter, a manual typewriter. And I bought the booklet 99 Lessons, How to Learn to Type.
Yeah.
So I spent all my evenings, every evening, learning how to type. That was right before starting grade 10. So then I started grade 10 and I had a typing class, but I started the class and I knew how to type. And I still have that typewriter right here in my office. But talking about pen, let me show you something here.
Ah, yes.
You mentioned Alexandre Dumas earlier.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I have a collection. I have the Agatha Christie also.
Uh-huh.
I have a collection of, this is my Dada. When I travel, I love to travel. Wherever I travel, I come back with some writing devices, mainly fountain pen. This is really my thing. Every morning I start my day by doing some morning pages. I have those grand cahiers and I just write whatever comes through my mind. It doesn't have to make any sense. It's just to get rid of whatever's inside me. So this is every day. It's a discipline that I've had. I remember I was keeping journals even when I was like 8, 9 years old. I've done that. I have cases and cases of a journal. The secrets that are in there. Yeah,
absolutely. But it's quite intriguing that I think we are seeing a generation now who may well view the actual ink writing or writing with a pen on paper as almost archaic as we arguably would view people who would use a quill pen and keep dipping in the quill pen into ink, a la Dickens, and so on and so forth. And again, there's lots of things to be talked about in terms of exploring that technology and the imprint. On the one hand, it makes it easier. On the other hand, we bring around to the next stage, the next question. Do you have any views or thoughts on the ever-rising prevalence of artificial intelligence and, of course, those wonderful chat GPT areas? Is that a danger to the creative writer, or is it something in which you can say, well, if I'm using a screenplay, it might be quite useful to actually have it set out in this format?
Yeah, this is still so new that we don't know about it. But I know that, you know, like many, many people, I GPT'd myself. So I learned that I was born in France. And I had written books that I've never heard the titles. So it was, I guess, a steep learning curve for it. But I still think that when I look, for instance, at the plot in The Ghost of Spiritwood, because there are many layers in that plot and in the characters, like even like the way they personally deal with death in their personal life. And then you have the accident that happened in that school or near that school. I'm not sure that unless you can infuse your artificial intelligence with real deep feelings and pain and fears, I don't know how they could come up with the intricate plot lines, you know, other than just like a single storytelling plot line, I would say.
I mean, I suspect Ray Kurzweil's view of the singularity is still something that people aren't necessarily comfortable with, because, as you said, it takes away that human part of the equation that is essential, if only for the nuance. Can you actually get that element of nuance in there with an artificial scenario? Some people might say you could. Again, it's something to debate and discuss in times to come. Advice, Martine. Somebody who might be listening to you as a well. In fact, let's work. Let's get even more kind of self-reflective in a Marcel Proust way. What advice would you give to the young 10-year-old Martine about life, the universe, and indeed where you'd head in subsequent years?
Don't be afraid. In The Ghost of Spiritwood, Alex, one of the characters, tells a story about that she got visited by her grandfather the night that he died, and he touched her hair. She was in her bed. He stroked her hair and he said, "Don't be afraid. I will always be there for you." And this is my own story. When I was 13 years old and my grandfather died, he was like 600 miles away from where I lived. But this is something that stuck with me. Don't be afraid. Do it. Like a high school dropout from Noranda, north of Quebec, what were the odds that I would end up being, you know, a writer?
An award-winning author being interviewed on the Midweek Drive Live in America, from Canada to Lincoln, England. Who would have thought it?
Who would have thought? Not me, that's for sure. But one of the best advice that I received came from my husband when I was working on my first novel. And my husband, he's not an artsy-fartsy. He's an electrical engineer. So I was writing the novel, and every night when he come home, I would say, "Oh, it's bad. It's just, you know," I would write like 1,000 words a day. Then at the end of a chapter, I would reread my chapter. I would reread every section. And the more I read my words, the more I was fueling the little sensor in me. And I was fueling, you know, giving a lot of fuel to the, "Oh, you're bad. Who do you think you are? What are you doing? You're wasting your time. Nobody's ever going to read this. This is shit," basically. So at one point, I think I had been on my novel for maybe like 3 months full time back then. And my husband said to me, "Stop reading. Write the whole thing. And once the whole story is on paper, then go back and read it. But stop doing that. You're killing yourself. You're going to abandon." And I would have abandoned the novel if it hadn't been for that advice, I'm sure.
And we just point out that for people who are a little bit sensitive, etc., obviously Martine was saying this is merd, not the other word that we actually heard. It's okay. It's important. We step away from that. It's fine. Martine. Online, martinenoelmoore.wordpress.com. Is that the best place to locate you? Or have you got secret TikTok accounts, Instagrams, and various other things in which people can actually follow your fabulous work?
No, I'm pretty quiet on social media. So, all my publications are on the Martine Noelma WordPress, yeah.
And as you said, number 17 is coming out very shortly. Do you want to tease ahead to that? Just trail a little bit more in terms of what we're going to see as the follow-up for the latest text?
I am actually right now, today, I am revising the first proof, but I'll give you a little, since you're in England, you're not going to show that to anybody.
Ah, Laika.
The art cover.
Who are Laika. You? Who are you? Where are you? Where are you? So, exactly.
This one takes place in southern part of the Saskatchewan in an area called the Badlands.
Yeah.
So it involves the disappearance of that cute little dog. And there's a skinwalker. Don't know if you've ever heard of the legend of the skinwalkers.
Yes.
And there's also some aliens.
Well, I was going to say, because Laika, is that a deliberate line? Because Laika, of course, the name of the first cosmonaut, the first canine cosmonaut that actually went up in the Soviet Union. So was that a deliberate attempt to connect the two things?
There is. And actually, the title doesn't come from me. This is another project that I did in a school. And the kids came up with that dog and the space. And
they'll be asking for percentage cuts next, Martin. You're going to have to be very careful in terms of the creativity from that side. You know, who knows what could happen? They'll get agents and who knows? Martin, it's been fabulous sharing some thoughts with your good self today. Genuinely impressed with the range you've actually shared with us. We have two final questions, which normally one of my students actually asks you, but they sadly were otherwise occupied today. So number one, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program? Has it been okay for you?
An interesting what? I'm sorry?
Zoomer. I'm using that as the noun for the way in which we're communicating. It's not a telephone link. It's not a Skype call. It's a Zoomer. Has it been good for you?
Oh, it's been doing great.
Excellent. Yes. Then the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to come back? Will you come back sometime and actually share with us more thoughts from Saskatchewan about life and times of Martine Noelmoore?
I would, with great pleasure.
In which case, all we have to say is bonjour et bonne chance.
Merci beaucoup, Alex. Au revoir.